Blog Talk Radio.
Well, folks, good afternoon. It's noon, and thank you very much for coming and listening one more weekend to Politics Done Right. I'm Egberto Willis, your host. Thank you for being here. This has been a rough week for America. There is no doubt. We have a government that is dysfunctional, that is not working. We have those who would try to equate what is occurring currently with false equivalences, and in doing so, does a disservice to all Americans. What am I saying? It is important if we are to move forward as a country to make sure that we do so with eyes wide open, and not only with eyes wide open, but to ensure that we never, ever cower because of what we think others may think, to tell truth. We should never, ever appease, because appeasement is what got us to the situation that we are here at now. We have allowed many, those who would say, let's stop it now. Let's stop those who would hurt the country now, and instead appease. I know that term is a lot. There's a term that many wanted to use on the president, on others, but no one really should appease. Now, today's show is supposed to be, or today's radio cast is a rather complicated one. I would really like to hear from true conservatives, because the country is in a dilemma right now. There is a posting that I'll have on Daily Coast on Sunday. I think it shows up at 8 o'clock, that I'd like you to read and leave some messaging, some information there. I think it's important. Specifically, it deals with the partitioning of the Republican Party and what it is actually doing to our body politic. Coffee Party as an organization is an organization that tries to bring people of all stripes together. All stripes, whether you're conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican, Green, Independent, whatsoever, to actually talk, to actually speak, but in doing so, to speak truth without regards to process. Now, I want to begin this blog post, and then I hope folks will call in and talk about it, because I think there's a lot going on in this country that is very important that many are missing. And you know, there are a lot of us in this business, in the business of activism, in the business of that tries to move the political process forward, that do a lot of instructing, doing a lot of talking. And the question is, are we making a difference? This morning, and before I go, I just have a little story to tell before I got into to do my show today. This morning I went out with one of the other groups that I'm in, Move to Amend, local Move to Amend, and we do some tablings. I think we reduced it now to about one Saturday a month. So today was the first Saturday of the month, so we went and did some tabling to try to make people aware of what's going on, corporate personhood, money is not speech, that sort of thing. And, you know, we had a couple of people come and sign up at the table. But one of the persons that came over to the table, she started to talk about, she's a young woman in community college. And she started to tell the problems that she's having with her utilities, with her car, and all these issues that's affecting her. But really what they were all issues that blocked her access to success, not because she wouldn't or didn't want to, but because of our current political process. The privatization of utilities meant her utility bills were high. It meant things like reconnection fees were intolerable. The privatizations of certain functions within the state of Texas has a material effect on her. The ability for her to go to school with a kid so that later on she can be a real taxpayer, net positive to society, is stunted. These are real things happening to real people. Earlier in the week, I received several emails with people stating positions. In fact, I got a few thank yous saying, wow, I think finally there are folks out there in this sphere that sees the real problems that everyday working middle class, working poor Americans are seeing. You know, we're all talking many times in high and mighty, nice words, but what are we doing to actually effect change for our fellow citizens? Are we just here with websites talking about how bad the corporation is? How bad corporations are? Or some corporations? How bad parties are? Are we actually just talking, or are we doing? When we ask you to make a pledge to us, we are asking you for your trust, we are asking you for your respect, and we are telling you it is our attempt to make a difference in the lives of the people we claim to serve. And you don't just do that by talking. Earlier this week, we had a couple of watch parties for Wendy Davis. In this case, this particular, as you know, here in Texas, we have a large population of the uninsured, yet our governor decided that for political reasons, he will not accept the Medicaid expansion to the Affordable Care Act, the Medicaid expansion to Obamacare. While I was tabling this morning, I witnessed personally people that decision affected. A woman that won't be going for her well woman test because we decided for ideological reasons, this state, the governor of this state, that he will not accept it. This week, one of our members will have a letter to the editor in which she will show that while she was lucky, her 20-year-old daughter, because of this bill, is going to be on her insurance policy till she's 26. She says, I am the lucky one. But my God, why can't my other Texans be lucky? And who is responsible for that? What is responsible for that? If you do not understand who is responsible for policies that are doing material harm to the body politic, material harm to you, material harm to your country, how then can you solve a problem if you do not know whom is responsible for these issues? It is imperative that Americans understand, if we are to do our job as activists, as promoters of truth, it is imperative that we just do that. This week, Ezra Klein had a wonderful program on with a segment. This segment had two very notable Republicans. One's name was, Bartlett, I think he worked for the first Bush. But that is what this particular blog is about. And I want to read it because it is rather important. And like I said before, this one is going to be featured on the front page of Daily Kos on Sunday. I think it should come out at 8 Central Standard Time. But here it goes. The blog is titled, Republican Says GOP is an Insurrectionist Neo-Confederate Party. And I'd like, when that blog piece comes out, it'll also be posted at my site. It's important that you not only read it, but you listen to these two serious gentlemen who had the courage to come out and speak in such a manner that folks understand this is not some sort of a vendetta against their own party. This is a plea to ask those in their party to actually come out. But here it goes. Over the last 30-plus years, apathy by Americans have allowed a party to manhandle the majority. Many claim that the major reason for this are the corruption of politics by money and corporate personhood. After all, is it not true that money can purchase an inordinate amount of false advertising to create a false reality? After all, if a corporation is given the rights of a person, does it not get free speech and all the protections of the Bill of Rights and, in effect, a vote? While both of these are true, ultimately it breaks down to an individual deciding to be learned or willfully ignorant. In America, each citizen still has one vote. In America, each citizen still has free speech. In America, each citizen still has the right to assemble and exchange ideas. When these are not exercised, it leaves a political vacuum. This vacuum could have been filled with political values intent on supporting policies and an environment in which the lives of all citizens are improved. Unfortunately, this vacuum was used to promote an ideology that excludes, vilifies, impoverishes, and divides. This is not a sentiment that is only held by liberals or Democrats. This is a sentiment also voiced by many notables in the Republican Party, as well. General Powell in the NBC interview spoke about a dark vein of intolerance in his party. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson had similar comments. Last December, Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann wrote the Washington Post essay, "Let's Just Say It, the Republicans Are the Problem." Last April, President Ronald Reagan's former budget director, David Stockman, in a recent interview said, "I think the Republican Party is not really a party. It doesn't stand for anything except reelecting itself. It's a coalition of gangs." There are scores of Republicans coming out ever so slowly in an attempt to take back their party. I can't wait for that day, folks. We need a solid multi-party system where we can check each other honestly, morally, based on what, based on ideological differences, but based on some sort of a compromise among people. Now I continue with the blog. Bruce Bartlett, former senior policy analyst in the Reagan White House and former deputy assistant secretary for economic policy in the George H.W. Bush White House, and Michael Lofgren, former staff member of the House and Senate Budget Committee for 28 years and author of The Party's Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted, appeared on All In with Chris Hayes. They provided the most shocking excoriation of what the Republican Party has become. And remember, these are notables. These are guys that want the party back. These are guys where we should all help to get real conservatism back so that we can really have honest dialogue. That's what we need. Anyway, Michael Lofgren said the following. This is not the 80s. This is something new. The party that I joined, he's referring to the Republican Party, the party that I joined was the party of Lincoln, the party of Theodore Roosevelt, the party of Eisenhower. They were patriots all. They were one, they were for one nation, indivisible. We have an insurrectionist neo-Confederate party that seems dedicated to all kinds of apocalyptic outcomes. I don't know if this comes from their fundamentalist religious outlook or whether it is just good fundraising for them among their base. But they are no longer a normal political party. They are an insurrectionist party that is bringing down the government. That's Michael Lofgren. Now, Bruce Bartlett said in the same piece with All In with Chris Hayes, and the whole video of it's about 6-something minutes long, I really would urge everyone to listen to it. It was a very, it was intellectual, but it was very, it laid things out in a manner that nobody would think somebody was bashing one party or the other. It was just fact-based. Bruce Bartlett said, "I think what we're really seeing here is a crisis of democracy, where one party believes its principles are so correct, so strong, and the other party's principles are so evil that we are essentially talking about God compromising with Satan, and you can't do that, and therefore they're justified by using any means necessary to get their way, despite the fact that the majority disagrees with them. They don't think that that matters in the slightest. The truth of their principles is the only thing that matters to them." The current political dynamics of the Republican Party is causing harm to the country. Let me get off my vlog a second and just explain that sentence, because in a group that is transpartisan, that's a loaded statement to which one must ask, is that true or not? Is that fact-based or not? Well, I think from everything that is known factually, it's more so than not. This is not a gray area. This is not maybe so, maybe not. All scholars say the same thing. Continuing. Most importantly, it illustrates a major defect in America's Republican democracy. If it were not for this defect, the intransigence of a minority would not be as important. However, with much less populous states having more power in the Senate than populous states, and with gerrymandering sending representation that does not reflect the aggregate sentiment and values of the represented, the corruption of government will continue for some time. One can only hope that as the lack of working middle-class-centric policies get thwarted by the intransigent and their effects are borne more visibly by those that vote for them, these constituents will vote them out accordingly. So far, this has not been the case, but one can hope that as more truth is made available through sources other than the traditional media, this will become a reality. This is the passion, personally, that I have for getting something done. This is a passion many of you have for getting something done. We simply want a country where we can have people of different thoughts, different beliefs, coexisting without the threat of one particular group, one particular party, one particular entity, whether that entity is a party, a part of a government, a plutocracy that is trying to hold the country hostage. Folks, the telephone number is 646-929-2495. I would really like to hear from you. The number is 646-929-2495. I think I have one caller here. 620, you're on. How can I help you, sir or ma'am?
Okay, this is Jack Golding.
Oh, hey. You know, Jack, by now I should remember your number.
Yeah.
How you doing, Jack?
I'm doing fine. I got some encouragement. I'm a little bit of an optimist. I think this whole thing may be resolved, hopefully, by Tuesday or Wednesday. Because I don't give a darn. Boehner, I think, I have any little confidence in, will not go into the debt crisis, will not hold out on the debt situation.
Right, that would be crazy, yes.
Yeah, okay. That would be worse, much worse than what is happening with the shutdown. I think they're going to pay the federal workers finally, and that's good news.
Yes, it is.
Good news for persons like myself, who, if I were working at my present job when I retired, would have been furloughed.
Right.
Because I am a PSDS technician. That has to do with payroll.
Right,
and
right.
They even consider payroll
non-essential
work.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I am hoping that with the Democrats, I'm going to say this, that the Democrats made a mistake by going with the sequester. I don't think the sequester has been discussed.
Actually, the sequester has been discussed. I want to elaborate on something that you said there, because this is important for people to understand. Many people out there are going to say, I put a piece out, I think it was yesterday, where McConnell and Paul were caught on an open mic where they were instigating a narrative, actually a false narrative, and they were saying, the Democrats are saying they're not negotiating. I don't think they poll tested that. And then he also said, I think ultimately, even though we don't want to be here, we are going to win, because we're going to start saying that at first we wanted to defund Obamacare, but now we just want to talk. Now we want to talk. In other words, he was lying. And I specifically said that within the blog post. Interesting enough, I got some pushback on that said, oh, I don't see where he lied. Of course, you have to follow politics, and that is so important. Why we have to be vigilant with not only the mainstream media, but with the politicians themselves. Because if you don't know what they said before, and you just listen to what they're saying now, you can't say, "Oh, he is lying now." Let's talk about that sequester issue you spoke about. The president wanted the budget to be $1.2 trillion. The Democrats wanted the budget to be $1.02 trillion. The sequestered budget was, I think, $980 something billion, and I think Paul Ryan's budget was $967 billion. So, in effect, when folks talk about compromise, the Democrats didn't compromise on the budget. The Democrats capitulated on the budget. Because the mere fact that they passed a CR that says, okay, $986 billion, it doesn't mean there was negotiations. It means there was capitulation. So when anybody, Ron Paul or McConnell, says that these guys say they're not negotiating or anymore or whatever, these guys didn't need to negotiate. They already capitulated. And
no, I know that. Okay, I know that's the error. And they got to restore that amount of money. They got to go line by line by line by line, saying which they're gonna add to. And
Jack,
for example,
you're right.
More on the diplomats in all over the world to be protected against situations like they had in Benghazi. Okay.
Absolutely. But Jack, you're right, but here's the deal. For that to occur, people have to know the truth. In other words, and I'm coming to you next, 210, people must know the truth. And to know the truth is saying that these guys are being disingenuous when they say, oh, we just want some negotiations, when the other side has already capitulated. So you have to have honesty in negotiations. The American citizens require that those of us who know this information, honestly, without regards to being worried as far as whose fault, be willing to tell this information. But let me go to 210. Jack, I'm leaving you hot. 210, this must be John from San Antonio.
Yes, John.
Talk
good
to me,
hear
John.
You.
Talk to me. Talk to me. How you been,
yeah,
my brother?
Yeah, that was a great piece that you wrote for tomorrow's Daily Kos. I saw that the show with Chris Hayes and Norm Ornstein and Mike Lofgren, and that was a great show, and it's a great example of Republicans, you know, true sane Republicans who, you know, want less spending, but they're reasonable, you know.
Yes.
I mean, I understand. I mean, again, going back to the Eisenhower Republicans or even the way Nixon viewed the economy, you know, that's the history of the Republican Party that I admire, you know. I mean, go for the little bit smaller government, but just be reasonable about it, you know. And so anyway, I want to start off by saying, you know, what will the Republicans inflict on us? Short-term stupidity or long-term destruction? I'd like to pivot to filibuster reform a little bit as it relates to preventing this from happening again. I used to be fairly conservative about filibuster reform because I believe that the Republicans ever took power, the Democrats as member of the Senate minority could thwart what you called in the subtitle of your book, right-wing doom. But after
right.
thinking about the reckless way that the Republicans are using now concerning raising the debt ceiling in 2011 and now this debacle, I agree with Jeff Merkley, the senator from Oregon, that Republicans,
right.
When they win the Senate, they will change the rules and they'll make it a majority rules institution. So I think
yeah.
the Democrats should do the same. And when the Democrats do have a majority in the House and in the Senate and hold the presidency, the thing that they should do is eliminate the debt ceiling completely. Only one other country, Denmark, has a debt ceiling, and, of course, they don't use it. I mean, they get along. They pass budgets. I mean, and also create a law that says if Congress cannot come to an agreement on appropriations, the government won't shut down, but will continue at last year's funding levels. Eric Voten talks about this in an article in the Washington Post on Monday, where he talks about other countries. They don't have government shutdowns. They may have civil wars. You know, they may
right.
not come to an agreement. But I mean, the European countries. And it's not just European. I mean, even you know, third world countries. They don't have government shutdowns
at all.
So.
Right.
You know, this is something that should be addressed, you know, I mean, in a sane world, it should be addressed by Republicans. But, I mean, you know, nothing's ever going to happen. You know, Jack was talking about the sequester. It's great to hope that it'll happen. But, I mean, realistically, is the House ever going to overturn the sequester? They want the sequester in place. They want the government to be not functioning right. They feel it's to their political advantage, and it was to their political advantage in 2010. There's no doubt about it. And you know, so that's where I'm coming from on this. It is a shame. If you look at the Time magazine piece, I don't know if you've seen that. It has a picture of the White House with dark clouds on the front. It says majority rules with scratched out. It's with a red
shame.
Marker. Yeah.
No, I haven't seen that one yet.
And so, I mean, I think that's a very, and that's kind of what your essay was talking about, very similar. You know, this is what I hear Democratic politicians talking about and the president himself, and I agree completely. You cannot give in to this. You cannot let somebody who, you know, holds one part of the government, you know, rule the government. I mean, you might
you
as
know,
well not even hold in an election, you
know. I know,
what's
John,
the point
it's
of having
more,
an election?
It's more dangerous than that because you notice in the end of the piece I said we have a structural defect in our democracy, and it really is true. And what happens is this. If we honestly take a look at this, first of all, we know for a fact that that in the Senate, smaller states are overrepresented in the Senate. Okay, they have a much larger voice in the Senate than they deserve based on the populations, which means their beliefs get preeminence over the average, the larger populations in big states. That's one problem. The next problem is the gerrymandering problem that has allowed that in as much as more people voted for Democrats in the House, the House doesn't only have a Republican majority, but a substantial Republican majority. And that is not I mean, that is not real. I mean, it is a defect in our system, and we have to call a spade a spade. In other words, it is a defect, and what it has done is the problems that we're having today that maybe we hadn't had before. I mean, this is a permanent defect that has been there all along, but that we have a sect, a group that is what I hate to say, but that is evil enough to exploit that defect. There are a lot of products with defects, right? And what we do with defects, we work around them. I mean, it's so difficult to fix the defect, we work around it. I write software. I have a few programs out there that have bugs. Now, do I go ahead and pull all the software back in from configuration management and recompile and put it all together when I can tell the user, well, for this particular configuration, don't use that because the path the software would take would cause it to crash? So we have a gentle person's agreement that we will simply not exploit that defect. Defects are usually exploited by the evil. Think about it. When they find a defect in Windows, who exploits that defect? Virus makers. Guys that are going to put viruses on your computer exploit the defect. Who exploits a defect in, you know, your car? Somebody who wants to get that analytical data. So what I'm trying to say here is, yes, it is true. No constitution is perfect. No law is perfect. But who actually exploits those defects? Most of the times, those defects are exploited by people who have no desire to do good. And I think it is important on us to actually put that out. I see another call, 816. 816. 816, is this Dr. Theis? 816? Huh, okay. If you want to speak, 816, please push 1 again. But anyway, John, so that's pretty much what I was trying to get across. The reason that today that I'm taking a certain tone is that I think many folks even within our group are equating telling the truth to make a difference or to effect a change is somehow out of process with getting things done or with getting acceptance. And I think that, I don't know if you started from the beginning of the show or not. But in the beginning, let me go ahead and put Jackson on take him off mic for now. But what I was trying to illustrate is that a lot of what's occurring today, John, is really our fault. Because just to keep peace, a lot of times we say, okay, let's just let them have that. And each time we let them have a little bit more till they take it all or till they take most of it. You see what I'm saying, John?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I mean, especially about the gerrymandering. But the problem with that is, you know, gerrymandering has been, you know, a decision has been made on the Supreme Court on gerrymandering is on the federal level, and they allow gerrymandering. And you know, and so as far as individual states, you can go for a system like California just put in place to where, you know, you'll have a separate committee actually set the people in the House, the boundaries in the House, to where they're not, you know, the leaders of the political parties. You know, obviously, you have Republicans doing their gerrymandering here. Now, you also have Democratic gerrymandering, and you know,
absolutely,
I'm a highly partisan Democrat, and you see it all the time on Daily Kos about Democratic gerrymanders. And so, you know, it's very hard if you have power, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, to say, well, gosh, I can manipulate this to have more votes, or I can, you know, make it more fair and probably lose some power by putting a nonpartisan committee in place. And so, you know, I mean, I think that should be done. I agree, but I mean, that is going to be a hard sell. And as far as the states, the smaller states having power, I mean, that's another thing that, I mean, they're never going to I guess the constitutional amendment would have to change that, and it just seems like that's such a hard thing to do, and the small states would never vote against themselves losing power. And so that's a really, really hard thing to put in place also. I think the things I talked about were actually obtainable. I mean, I'm not saying what you weren't talking about. I mean, those things are obtainable. I personally think the Supreme Court gerrymandering should be made illegal. I think all 50 states should have separate nonpartisan committees that that draw their own lines. And that's the way I think it should be done. I think that's the only fair way to do it. I guess it could be overturned by the Supreme Court. I mean, if you look at Plessy versus Ferguson was essentially overturned by Brown versus the Board of Education. There are all kinds of other precedents. So, I mean, you know, it could happen, and I hope it does happen. But, I mean, it just seems like the odds are pretty high. And
I wasn't suggesting that we change it. Notice that what I was also saying is there's a defect in our thing. I think you're absolutely correct. Okay? In other words, I think it gets, what is the word? You know, I just got a message saying that somebody trying to call 646-929-2495 kept the phone ringing. I think what I'm trying to say is that we constantly find that the Constitution has been with us for a long time. And it has worked for a long time, right? So, I mean, it only works when you have those who are willing to go ahead and use its deficiencies against the body politic against us. And I think that is what has happened. I think these folks are using the problems with it against us.
Right, but I mean, what's happening as far as the debt ceiling and the shutdown, those aren't constitutional issues. I mean, we could just pass laws that you know, say, like I just said, about like all the other countries do, and just say, you know, if you can't get along, we're not going to shut the government down. We'll have a CR that, you know, and the government won't shut down. And also, you know, with the debt ceiling, I mean, there's no reason to have a debt ceiling. I mean, you just appropriate money the debt ceiling actually has no impact on the appropriation of money at all. It just should be eliminated. I mean, Pelosi talked about this when they first started, Republicans first started talking about it. I agree with you that there are structural problems, but I think the main problem are the Republicans. I mean, because again, we had all of these, this has never been a problem. The debt ceiling's been in place since 1917, and it was put in place because they needed to not always have votes all the time because they were appropriating so much money for World War I, and so instead of having votes all the time, they just said, okay, we'll put a certain level on it. And, you know, it should have been eliminated a long time ago, but, I mean, since most politicians never used it like this before, they didn't see a need to eliminate it. Now, there was the Gephardt rule that basically started in 79 and lasted until Gingrich was around in the mid-90s, which tied the appropriations bills to the debt ceiling. And so there wasn't a separate vote for the debt ceiling. That's what makes it so different than all other countries, that there's a separate vote. I mean, there should just be one vote for appropriation.
Exactly. That is so smart what you just said. I think what you just said is so important. In other words, then the fight is only about appropriating money, right? In other words, as soon as you appropriate, if it's less than the tax revenues, then it is an automatic increase in the debt ceiling. Which it sounds silly. It's not an automatic increase in the debt ceiling. It means you're authorized to print bonds or to sell bonds to pay your bills, right?
Yeah. I mean, there have been people who say you don't even really have to do that. James Galbraith has said that you just appropriate the money that was used. But that's the way it's done. That's the way the world financial institutions want it done. And so again, I don't want to go back. I spent a lot of time on this last week about the platinum coin, and I don't know, how serious.
Well, we have different listeners every week. So, why don't you tell a little bit about the platinum coin? It's kind of interesting.
Well, yeah, this is a way out of this. And it's kind of sad that I think that people aren't talking about this, because this is the third time around on this. Obviously, 2011 was the first time in July, and in January, we were going to hit the debt ceiling, I think, on February 15th. And so, in January, a lot of people were talking about this as a way out. And essentially, what it is that there are limits on the amount of money that can be printed in circulation in the United States. But there's also a law that was passed in 1996 that says that you can make these commemorative coins only platinum coins. And basically the Treasury makes them, and they sell them, to make money for the Treasury. The coin collectors get these. And the loophole, just like the loophole for this ridiculous debt ceiling, which is essentially a loophole, a stupid law that says we have to vote on paying our bills again after we've already appropriated money to pay for them. Then we have to approve it again. Is just as silly, if not even sillier, because of the consequences if this isn't approved, the catastrophe that would happen, as the platinum coin. So the platinum coin, basically the idea is, the loophole is that they did not put any kind of amounts on there. And so the idea is you print a $1 trillion platinum coin, and you deposit it into the Fed, and once the Fed takes that, then essentially the government has $1 trillion to spend, and you're not in a debt crisis anymore, and you can pay Social Security, and you can pay Medicare, and you can pay Medicaid, and you can pay the soldiers and everybody else that's affected by the government. And so that is the idea, and I hope people start talking about it again. I was watching flipping channels this morning, and they had hedge fund hotshot, and he was saying basically how Jack Lew was scaremongering, and he said that Obama, he obviously didn't know anything about the real procedure of raising the debt ceiling, and he said that Obama could approve it, that Obama would never let this happen. I hope he's right in that. Because I think it's very important. As much as it's 99.99999% the Republicans' fault, Obama has a chance to not, have catastrophe happen. Now, Boehner has said, numerous times, and a lot of Republican leaders have said numerous times, the default won't happen, and because they know how terrible this is. There are some really silly people like Rand Paul and what I call debt ceiling deniers who don't think that catastrophe will happen, but they're just like the climate change deniers. Nothing is based in facts. Their lies are not based in facts, and It's really, really sad that they live their lives like that. But, a lot of people do believe that. It's amazing to me. Even though the polling has been very good, I don't mean to take this down to a political measurement, because I don't want to see, people look at this as this is good for the Democrats, because it's terrible
right.
for the country. But it does, Republicans have to think about how it's going to affect him. The 21 people, Republicans in the House who are going to vote for or talked about voting for his clean CR, only two of them come from red states. The rest all come from blue states. And in blue states, you know, in New York and in California and in Pennsylvania and Virginia, I mean, you know, people are just so angry about this, and they know who to blame. I don't know if you're
actually no.
Familiar.
Actually, let me. I want to correct that. No, they don't know who to blame, or they look. And that is why it, that is why I gave the sort of entry point where I said it is our responsibility. Yourself, myself, and all, those others that are really into the political stream, because you and I and our listeners, we follow politics. We know that. We know these things. The problem is that many folks don't. And, you know, a lot of times we live in our own bubble as well, John. A lot of times we sit down there and think, how, you know, I think I've gotten a lot. As I've become more embedded in doing activist work, I think I've become more humble. And the reason why is that you realize that we, those of us that follow this stuff, we live in a bubble. Because we know, you know, we always talk about the other folks that live in a bubble. We live in a bubble of constant information. So we know whenever we see something, we have a very large BS meter. You know, we can sit down and say, oh, that's BS. But when you look at how other people that are going to work every day, going to work at McDonald's, even engineers going to work aerospace or whatever, the last thing is on their mind is Obama or Boehner or anything like that. They are going to work thinking about that next calculation they got to do, the son that has to go off to college. A lot of times they are not thinking about this, and the only time they get information is the 15 or 20 minutes they're going to see on CNN or Fox News or whatever. And when you have a Fox News that lied to them continuously, or a CNN that appeases the point, you know, that makes things look like they're false equivalencies, makes it, well, the Republicans are saying this and the Democrats are saying that, you know, people either tune out or they're misinformed. So you and I and others listening here, we live in a space where we know. Unfortunately, most people do not live in that space. And since we are now on social media, you and I communicate on Facebook and Twitter and all these things. And a lot of people, when they have a little bit of dead time, they're going through their feeds. They click on something from a trusted friend. That is why it is so important that you and I do what we are doing. And that is informing other folks. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just needed to get that out.
Yeah, no, I agree though. But if you listen to what I said, I said that the people who were really the ones who wanted the Republicans in the House who want to pass the clean CRs, they are from states that Obama won, and so they're getting more pressure. I should have said they're getting more pressure from their constituents than somebody like, you know, like I know your congressman is Ted Poe, my congressman is Lamar Smith. I mean,
yes.
You know, I'm sending emails, you're probably sending emails,
yes.
or calling, but I mean, you know, as a percentage, how much are they getting from people who are against their beliefs? I mean, probably not that much. That's why, that's again going back to the gerrymandering. But you know, in other states, I mean, you like one of the examples, I think it's already, you can just look at the polling, you know, and see how it's affecting it. But you can also look at the generic polling when they asked people who you're going to vote for in the next election. And they had three polls out and they all went highly in Democratic areas. Right now, the Quinnipiac poll is a +9. And when,
oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and that was, I think, released on Wednesday. The PPP poll had, I think, a +6. And also, you know, another way is to look at the presidential races. I know it's
right.
3 years away, but, I mean, that also took a drastic turn. Like they had one poll that was a national poll, Hillary Clinton versus Christie, and Christie at the beginning of the year, Hillary Clinton had a big lead. Well, she had a big lead at the beginning of the year. Then it kind of got close again. And now she has a 13-point lead over Christy and, you know, like a 15-point over Rand Paul and a 23 over Ted Cruz. And so, I mean, this is, to me, this is showing that, that this is having an impact. People,
right.
People do know what, I mean, I'm not, I mean, I agree with you. You know, most people need to get more politically involved, and a lot of people don't put a lot of time into politics. They're not obsessed about politics. Yeah, but, and especially in 2014, it's hard to get people out. It's hard to get even people who, you know, follow it a little bit. It's hard to get
right.
them out to vote. And so, I mean, that's an unfortunate situation for the Democrats, who do better in election years when all the publicity is going into, you know, presidential election years. And so, yeah, I mean, I do think, you know, it is hurting people more, and I think it is more centrist. I mean, if you know, and I know there people don't refer to them as centrist that much because they're really not centrist. But I mean, people who are in swing districts,
right?
They're going to be getting more, you know, more backlash on this, and eventually they're going to want to cave. I mean, I don't think they're going to. I think it's going to be tied in with the debt ceiling. That's pretty much the common knowledge that it's going to go on until the night of the 17th. Now I hear that it may be moved back just because all, you know, the money that hasn't been spent yet, you know, may force it back. It's not going to force it back too much, but it may force it back a day or two.
Right.
And so it may not be the 17th. It may be, you know, the 19th or whatever. But I mean, there's going to be a confrontation and somebody's going to blink. And,
well,
you know,
we'll see. John, stick with me. I think I have Dr. Theis on 816 now. Dr. Theis, are you there?
Yeah, I am, Egberto.
You finally made it in.
I finally made it in. I had a tough time calling in. It was ringing and ringing and ringing. Don't know if any of your other listeners are having the same problem, but...
Well, I don't think so.
Well, okay. It must have been my phone then. I don't know.
Well, first, let me
I
tell you, Dr. Theis actually said that I must not have paid my telephone bill, why he couldn't get in. No, Doc, I paid it.
I figured you did. You saw the little smiley face afterwards.
Yes, I did.
John gave some interesting history, which was very accurate, and so I was happy to hear that again, help me remember some things. But... I wanted to put something else out there for consideration. And John said something about the debt deniers, the debt ceiling deniers, and the climate change deniers, and they just don't understand the consequences. And I'd be willing to argue that many of them do understand the consequences. They just don't care. I mean, I think the Koch brothers, who are funding much of the anti-climate change work, they know that the climate is changing. They understand that, but to acknowledge that would mean a big hit to their pocketbook. So they're going to do everything they can to deny it, knowing that they're probably going to be dead and buried before the problems start to hit. And I would say it's the same thing with the debt ceiling deniers. People like Ron Paul, he wants to return us to a gold standard. That's incredibly contractionary. It would cause huge problems. But he doesn't care because he wants a minimalist government. And one way to get to a minimalist government is to prevent the government from borrowing money. So this fits what they want. The other thing that Republicans want sort of is the centerpiece of their ideology is that government doesn't work. So the debt ceiling debacle, if we do have a problem with it, just fits. And they can say, see, government doesn't work. And I think that's part of what's going on here. You know, Obamacare, their biggest fear is that it will work and that another generation of Americans will be happy and see the government can have a positive effect in their lives. From 1932... to the mid-1960s, Republicans essentially had no chance of winning in most of the country. And the one presidential election they won, Eisenhower was basically a Democrat. And he had been courted by the Democratic Party, too. Well, if the Affordable Care Act gives insurance, gets health care for 50 million Americans, that's 50 million Americans who see their lives improved by government that will vote for the Democratic Party, and it will again, for 30 years or so, maybe even longer, keep the Republican ideology that government can't do any good. It'll totally undermine that. And that's the problem Republicans, I think, are facing. Their worldview doesn't work if government succeeds. So they want government to be unsuccessful. They want failures. They want catastrophes.
That is something that you and I have spoken about that before when we were there. I'm not politicking, but doing our civic duty, and I have to agree with you wholehearted. Now let me go to 954. Stay with me, Doc, and keep in the discussion. 954. Who do I have the honor of speaking with?
It's Neil. How you doing?
Hey Neil, what's going on?
I agree with your previous caller. I mean, this is an insurrection. This is, to me, is treason. What they're doing is they're under the orders of Adelson, Koch, and everyone else, all these billionaire despots who are their bosses. They're basically taking down the United States of America, and they're coming after Social Security and Medicare next.
Neil, it's funny that you use those terms, because when I wrote the blog post for this show, I wanted to make sure to stick within my civil intent, but I needed to use that for one reason, because a very notable Republican, those were his terms. His term was an insurrectionist neo-Confederate party. And if you listen to the video, I didn't put it all in the blog post, but if you listen to the video, what the guy is stating is that, if you remember, the current Republican Party is comprised of, I'm going to have to put one phone on, let's see which phone is that. No, that's not San Antonio. Bear with me one. That's maybe your phone, Neil. I'm putting you on off mic for a while. But if you remember, the Dixiecrats are now a large component of what used to be the Republican Party. And what he was saying is, he said in the discussion that follows, and please, folks, the blog post for the show also includes a link to a video. The name of the well, actually, I'm sorry. That won't come out. I can't post that until tomorrow, because it actually has first dibs at the Daily Coast, so I can't post that until tomorrow. But the video has the part where the guy says, this party is really, we know, a Southern party, where the gravity of the party, the center of gravity of the party, is really the South. And these are the guys that were comprised of the old Southern portion of the Democratic Party, known as, what is it, Doc? I think the Dixiecrats, right?
Yeah.
And that is just the... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, and I think you're right about that. And many of them were Democrats in the South. And when the federal government began using its power to enforce civil rights, pass civil rights legislation, they jumped ship and became Republicans.
Now, enlighten me historically, because, and remember the title of the show today, so we're talking about the Republican Party specifically, and you guys saw the promo for the show, and I want to get this right. This was the Republican Party always associated with this mantra of limited government throughout its creation? I don't know.
No, actually, Doc? You know, the Republicans like to call themselves the Party of Lincoln, because Lincoln was the first Republican president. Teddy Roosevelt was an interventionist Republican. Both parties had sort of big government progressive wings and conservative business wings within them. The Democratic Party, with the Great Depression, became the majority party. The Depression affected working class and poor people much worse than the wealthy, although it affected everybody. And the poor and the working class that had been voting Republican started voting Democratic. And a large percentage of that were poor blacks. And so the Democratic Party had a fundamental problem in the 1930s into the 1940s, and that was that poor working class blacks and segregationist whites were both supporting him. It was an internal contradiction.
Oh,
and in 1948, the segregationist Democrats walked out and nominated their own candidate in Strom Thurmond. And he ran as a Dixiecrat. Truman won the election anyway over Dewey, but that rift had become public, and Truman integrated the military, and the Democrats began to move more pro-civil rights, and it was in conjunction with Republicans. And Southern Democrats began to look for a new home. But, you know, Republicans were totally defeated for 30 years, with the exception of Eisenhower, and they didn't control the House for 40 years, from 1950.
Now, Doc, enlighten me on one other issue. I need to be enlightened in one other issue. The party of Lincoln is a party of things like the Emancipation Proclamation and progressivism. Is that correct?
To a large degree, yeah.
Now, how did they lose that mantra to what one can consider a fairly racist Democratic Party?
How they lose that mantra? Well, they did, really, Strom Thurmond's candidacy exposed the cracks in the Republican Party. In 1964, Barry Goldwater ran as a conservative, and he was proud of it, against Lyndon Johnson, who was a Southerner, but who also was progressive on civil rights and other issues. So, you know, Johnson did the war on poverty. Johnson got the Civil Rights Act passed, the Voting Rights Act, 64 and 65. So that really alienated Southern Democrats. Well, Goldwater carried, I believe it was South Carolina, Mississippi, and Alabama in 1964. As a Republican, when he talked about states' rights in the midst of the civil rights sort of struggle, Southern segregationists saw that as, we're going to be able to go back to segregation. And in 1968, Wallace ran an independent bid for a third-party presidential race, and Nixon sort of adopted some of those ideas. And that was really hit home by Reagan, who went to some city in Mississippi in 1980 to announce his platform and talk about states' rights. And so Republicans, basically in an attempt to win, decided to appeal to segregationist Southerners. Even the issue of affirmative action, Nixon, a Republican, was the one that implemented affirmative action in the federal government. So that was 1972. And most people don't even realize that. But it was a method to win elections. Now, what's happened is they created a monster they couldn't control. And now they've got people like Rand Paul or Ron Paul or some of these others that are running in the South that actually, you know, it's amazing to me. Many of them cloak themselves in sort of this libertarian ideology that talks about freedom. But I've read a lot of libertarian books, and they don't care about freedom for black people. In fact, some of the libertarian books actually talk about how the South was a very idyllic place, and slaves were very well taken care of. And therefore, slavery really shouldn't be a big issue.
Well, I think Rand Paul said as much until he had to not say it all again.
Right. And his campaign advisor had written for neo-Confederate websites, etc. So, I you know, the Republican Party is too bad it's taken that turn. Because I was a person that actually voted Republican for Reagan one time in 1980. But I think what's happened over the last 30 years is they've moved farther and farther to the right.
And to think that we actually thought that Reagan was sort of to the right, in as much as he was a charismatic fellow. But yeah, and
Reagan
now how
was to the left of Obama.
You know what? It is amazing that in some instances that is true, except on Obama.
It is.
Well, yeah, it is amazing that on some instances that is true. I mean, I would take umbrage in saying that I think most of it is a political act for survival as opposed to what he really believes, because there's a lot of video out there that actually would make one believe that this guy is a lot more liberal than he's actually governing.
Well, let me rephrase that. Reagan governed to the left of Obama.
Right. That I think that's a better concept, yes.
Yeah.
Or a better statement. But anyhow, so let me – one other question, though, and this one is more important. How did we get to the point – where, what's the word I want to use? Supply side economics was not only the ideology, but the Bible of this party. Because I don't think Eisenhower, who is the guy who was heavy on infrastructure, come on, he built the freeway system. How did that become the mantra or the Bible?
Well. It's been probably a 50-year struggle by people who don't like government interference to shape public opinion through think tanks, through books. I mean, think how popular Ayn Rand is.
You mean that woman that when she died was on welfare, meaning Social Security?
Well, she was on Social Security and Medicare. Yeah, they don't like to talk about that.
Can I say something about Ayn Rand, too?
Yeah, come on in real quick, yeah. Neil.
Ayn Rand also worshipped a child murderer. They don't like talking about that, a man who eviscerated a little girl. They don't like talking about that, and she got Social Security under her maiden name. But it's kind of like a weird mix between Ayn Randism and this libertarian mix and this plutocratic mix, because the Tea Party the copy of what they were talking about, what they were, was really hiding their insidious intentions, because from the very beginning they were funded by the Koch brothers, and every other billionaire despot whose major goal is to lower wages, get rid of overtime, get rid of Medicare and Medicaid, and basically turn everybody into more or less serfs to create a dystopian America that basically is a kingdom. They have more in line with King George than they are with our founding fathers.
You know, it's interesting. Crystal Ball did a great piece on this we lost somebody. Neil, I guess you must have fell off, Neil, so you may want to call back. But Crystal Ball did a great piece on that. I think she kind of equated it with Somalia. But it's interesting that you speak about this dystopia. But I want to come in a partial defense of the Tea Party, because I know a whole lot of Tea Party folks. And while and by the way, there's more than one real Tea Party. There are folks in the Tea Party who were genuinely — I'll put you back on, Neil. There are folks in the Tea Party who genuinely thought the Tea Party was what it said. It was a nonpartisan group that simply wanted folks to not – whoops, I'm getting an echo from somebody. Unmute if you can, please, or mute if you can. Now, they were a group that honestly believed that they weren't for this bailout of the corporatocracy, the bailout of the banks. They weren't for these things. And, you know, in as much as back then I was myself such scared – of what was happening, that I actually supported the bailout as well, and now I have to give myself second thoughts. But I think some of these guys were honest in their beliefs. They weren't the racist guys that you see there. They weren't the, you know, all these crazies. They weren't. I met a few that really believed. And as much as the leadership in a lot of this stuff came from the Kochs, they were misled into what the Tea Party really was. And I met some honest-to-goodness folks that is exactly how they thought. In fact, we had this thing at the coffee party in Washington, D.C. called the Enough is Enough Rally. And in the Enough is Enough Rally, we had several thousand people on the front lawn at the Capitol. And, you know, we had speeches and we talked about what we needed to get done or whatever. And I bunked with a Tea Party guy. And this guy eventually left when the Tea Party changed because it became nothing that he assumed it was or, you know, what he joined it for. But this is a genuinely conservative Southern dude from Waco, Texas. But he was an honest guy. He believed in, you know, he believed in compromise and all of that. And then he finally found out that's not what they were anymore. And he came by. I think this, Jack, you want to say something else? It seems like you just came on real quickly.
Who, me?
Yeah, you just pushed the number one.
Okay. Yeah, I guess not all Tea Party people are crackpots.
Right, they're not.
The white guy from Waco, Texas, makes me think that there are some reasonable guys. You have to get, but they're just, a lot of them just don't know what the hell they're, anything about politics.
Now, Jack, that is exactly what's going on. And that's what I was talking to John from San Antonio before. Whereas what happened is a lot of these people, these guys are marketed to, okay? In other words, the Koch brothers and all these guys have a lot of money that they can pay for research on what rings in somebody's mind, how one's mind work, etc. And that is exactly how they get a lot of these people to sign up because they have the messaging just right. It is tested. It's not only poll tested, but it is, you know, they know exactly what they're doing, and it's worked. That is the reason we have to do what we're doing. That is the reason why we have, and it doesn't work with me telling somebody else that doesn't know me. It works better when we use this social media mechanism where you're interacting with people who know you. You know, because Dr. Theis is a political genius. He could come out and he could say anything. He has that doctor in front of his name. He knows all these sort of things. But even that, to Tea Partiers, they have learned to believe. They have been taught to believe that climate change isn't real, that a college professor, in as much as he's put in decades of studies, let me listen to Rush Limbaugh. You know what I mean, Doc?
Well, they've been told that the liberal university is part of the problem. And so anybody that's a college professor must be part of the liberal college, the liberal university, and you can't pay attention to them. You know, I think we have to put the Tea Party in context. They're by and large middle-class white Americans who watch their parents work hard and do better their entire life and move up in social status. As they have come to work over the last 30 or so years, they're not doing better. They grew up in a time where there was big government. And so the message that government's the reason you're not doing better, government's taking your money and so you're not able to have a better life, is incredibly appealing to them. What they don't realize is that at the same time we had the big government, we also had the rise of corporate capitalism. And government was the one entity with sufficient power to control corporate capitalism. And as we have cut the power of government, reduced its role in our society, corporations have correspondingly grown in power and in their role in society. And guess what? Things aren't getting better for working class Americans. They are scared. They're worried about their standard of living, quite rightly. But they're not putting the blame on the right place.
You know, I think that is so important. They don't know who the real boogeyman is. And not only that, it is, I think, for the survival of our corporatocracy, it actually is important that these guys start blaming the government. Because think about it. If you don't blame the government, who then do you blame? When you can't afford the things, who then do you blame? When you can't afford a house, who then do you blame? So they have to preempt, because they have to give you a boogeyman before you find who the boogeyman is. You know, I mean,
realize that at the time you and I were growing up, when most of these Tea Party people were growing up, government was proactively working to help people of color get a piece of the American dream.
Right.
So that plays very nicely into Southern sort of concerns or Southern fears about the activist government changing their way of life, about black people becoming in charge, black people getting special treatment, etc. So that race card is sort of an undercurrent that fits very nicely with the government is too powerful message.
Right. It is sort of what I'm saying. All these things are poll tested, and they work. They work on that human nature that we all have, that, you know, we fear the unknown, we fear what we're not familiar with, and that is the kind of stuff we have to overcome. I mean, that is the kind of stuff. Go ahead, Doc.
Do away with blame. Somehow that is one of the things blame game is what's holding up. Because people don't know, they can blame. Hello?
Yes, I got you, Dak. I got you. Yeah, come on in, Neil.
You know, this is how also I've never, I mean, we have to blame, you know, the Tea Party never has reacted really to the banks. The banks have taken $1 billion worth of property from people under the mortgage crisis with phony, taking away people's property, and they were charged $100 million. Nothing in the newspapers. They've been running drug money. Nothing in the newspapers because they're owned by the same people who pretty much run the Tea Party. It's all interconnected. I mean, there has to be a boogeyman, and the Tea Party has always been about building resentment against people who are not white, people who are poor, women. The way the Tea Party goes after women, because women have gained so much power over the last 30, 40 years. That's why their goal is so unbelievably insidious. They want to go after everyone. Eric Cantor, I forgot the HR, but he tried to pass a bill more or less banning overtime. It died in the House. But that was a direct order from the Koch brothers. It really is frightening what their agenda is. And basically, they've been wanting to shut down the government since 2010.
Well, at this point, it is extortion. I mean, I tell folks again, please, after my thing, I have to put you on hold a second, Jack,
sure. Because
you're coming noise. No, it was Jack. I meant Jack's mic was kind of open up. Now, that's the reason that I posted this piece from Chris Hayes, because, you know, Egberto as a liberal, or Neil as a liberal, or John as a liberal, we can say certain things, but we don't have as much credibility when we are pointing out certain things within a Republican Party or a Tea Party or whatever. We have to have allies to help. I mean, we can give all the factual information, but at that point, we're only preaching to the choir. But when you have a Bartlett come out or a Stockman or a Powell, well, not Powell so much, because Powell always had a special place in the Republican Party that they never really considered him much of a Republican. But other conservatives within the party, when they come out of the woodworks, which I think they've done the country a large injustice by taking so long to come out. Because if you think about it, since the president has been President Obama has been president, if we had just done the things that they would have done if it were a President McCain, this economy would be zooming right now. If we think about this, all the things, all the policies that these guys have dropped, all the policies these guys have put down, infrastructure type policies, policies that are nonpartisan, that they have not done simply because it's this guy putting them out there, tells you how far ahead our economy could have been right now. Don't you think, John, San Antonio?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, Paul Ryan he voted for the Bush stimulus. When Bush did a stimulus in 2001, there's tape of him on the House floor praising it.
I posted that.
And so, I mean, yeah, it absolutely. I mean, this is something that is just in opposition. This comes from their meeting in January 2009. And just like this whole shutdown comes from a similar meeting called the Williamsburg Accord, where basically Jonathan Chait writes about it in The New Yorker. Well, they all got together and they all basically planned this out. This is completely planned out. I mean, Republican press has been writing about this since it took place. I mean, if you Google this Williamsburg Accord, you'll see all this information about it. And so this is completely planned, and it is totally laughable when Republicans say this is a Democratic shutdown. I mean, there is nothing farther from the truth. They've been talking about this, well, like what Neil said, as soon as they took power, they were already talking, and when they won the election, before the new House was even put into place, they were talking about the debt ceiling. And now with the Williamsburg Accord, they've been talking about this. And I actually saw somebody on the House floor, Republicans, saying this morning when I was watching C-SPAN, they were saying, oh, this, how can people blame this on the Republicans? Is this all the Democrats' fault? I mean, this is anybody who's been following this knows that that's the difference. I would also like to bring one point up about Dr. Theis was saying. This is a little bit of an argument that I've had with one of the guys on Netroots Radio, the guy at Justice Putnam. He makes the point that that essentially what's going on in the South and what you talk about is the insurrection has a lot more to do with racism than it does with anything else. And I make the point that racism is very much there, and what Dr. Theis was talking about, the LBJ statement when he signed the Civil Rights Act, saying we lost the South now. I mean, at the very first, a few states did, go Republican fairly quickly, but there were a lot of states like Texas that did
Yes, long time.
That stayed Democratic for quite a long time until essentially the 90s, 80s, 90s. And I think what happened, what the difference is that people bought in to supply-side economics, trickle-down economics. That was sold to the people, and that actually has more of an impact than the racism. I mean, the racism has an impact. I mean, you look at Mark Potek with the Southern Law Center and all the good work he's done there. There's no doubt that racism is up, and that's terrible.
Let me tell you, John, I want to break here because I want to, first of all, tell you that you're absolutely right. I haven't listened to his show where he said that, but you're absolutely right. It's racism is more a tool of the plutocracy than anything else, okay? And that is what I think a lot of folks haven't played right. Both civil rights leaders and activists, I think they have allowed racism to be used as that tool. In other words, what I'm trying to say is, if you look at racism as endemic to the problem, you've missed the boat, exactly what you're saying. If you look at racism as a part of the as a chisel within the toolbox of the plutocracy to help get their point across, and it's the same thing with the women's with what they're doing with women, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, you put a racism element in there, you put the war on women element in there, you put all these factions fighting against each other, and guess who's left standing? And that's what it's all about. It's not it's not about trying to. Folks know, most folks are intelligent in 2018. The folks that run our body politic are intelligent to know that that race is just an inconsequential thing. It's the low information people, the less educated people that still think race is of substantial value. And that is what we, you know, and those are the kinds of things that we have to get across. Now, there's something else that you say, because I get some pushback from very few on when I post to the Coffee Party site. Very few, but a few. And the pushback is usually because there's something that you mentioned there. You mentioned about, hey, there was a time when Paul Ryan was on the floor saying that he supported this type of infrastructure project, that he supported... there's a whole lot that all these guys.
Yeah, it was a stimulus.
Support.
It was a direct stimulus. It was $300 that every person got when Bush first came
right.
into office.
And he comes and he votes for it and he supports it. Now, all these types of information, which is mostly Republican based, right? Because these are the guys that are fighting these current policies that are middle class centric. A lot of times I get pushback. Why are you being partisan on this site? From very few, look at the likes. Most of the people see it, and that's what, you know, it's like, wow, I got that. Wow, thank you for showing me that. Wow, I'm happy to see that, because they didn't know. That can help frame their minds for those that are honest or intellectually honest. For partisans, for absolute ideologues, not partisans, but absolute ideologues, it won't mean a thing. But for those people that we are trying to reach, those people that mean something, bringing the evidence, bringing the realities, bringing the truth of where these guys used to be and what they're saying today immediately puts into context the hypocrisy, but not only puts into context the hypocrisy, put into context why it is that they have to engage to get those folks out. And I think if you're going to be an activist and if you have a platform, it is your responsibility to do that. Otherwise, you're an abject failure. John?
Yeah, I mean, different people can do different things. I mean, I'm personally an activist. I mean, I was hoping to go to an event at Mr. Cruz's office in San Antonio, but my mom was sick. But I mean, like in 2011,
okay?
Yeah, she's all right. She's 2011. I was in a lot of events, that was the year of Occupy, but I mean, even outside of Occupy, town halls with Mr. Canseco, who's not in office anymore, so I'm very happy about that. And,
right.
I was very, very vocal. I had 4 pages prepared before we went there, and the first question I asked him was, in 1933, FDR took the unemployment rate from 25% to 15% by putting a series of work projects in place like the WPA.
Right.
Mr. Obama has already passed the stimulus. I think at the time it already had 2 million people were employed because of the stimulus. Now he wants to extend the stimulus. This is for the fall of 2011. And why are you against the stimulus? And, basically he didn't have an answer. And anyway, I just continued on and on, stating facts to him, stating how history has, shown how Keynesian economics has worked. And, he basically either didn't reply or, gave some lame answer. And it's great to have, people backing you up and saying, the next question, you have somebody, you didn't answer his question. Could you please answer the gentleman's question? And
right.
So, I mean, it's always, yeah, so it was a very great event. And, I hope things will change. I'm hoping we'll have protests at Lamar Smith's office. Somehow, I don't think if they keep this up, they can't continue government by crisis. I mean, that's the one thing. If Boehner does the right thing and he says, I'm not going to default, whether it happens on the 17th or the 19th or even before, they still have to raise the debt ceiling by a certain amount. And so this is what they were talking about in the summer. Are they going to go small? Are they going to go big? And, they could just raise it for another, month or another few weeks, and this just continue this government by crisis, and that is
but
a
here's
political
the deal.
Loser. That's a political loser for the Republicans.
Yes, it is, but
it
you know what?
It will kill
sad?
The Republican Party.
What is sad is, like I mentioned, I don't know if you heard earlier in the program where I said, I gave the four numbers, $1.2 billion from the president, $1.02 billion from the Democratic Senate, $986 from the Congress, and $968 from the from Paul Ryan. The Democratic Senate has accepted the $968 number from the Congress. What that is complete Democratic capitulation. Complete.
Right. But one thing.
Go ahead.
Well, one thing about that, though, is that just funds it until, I mean, they actually have two different funding dates. The House funds it until December 15th. The Senate funds it until November 15th. And so those numbers will just be in effect for whenever it goes on until then. And so then we're going to have to do this all over again. I mean, you
right.
know, unless they're going to continue. I mean, and so, you know, I agree with what Jack said earlier. I mean, Democrats should be working on, you know, defunding the sequester. But, I mean, that's so hard when the Republican Party won't move and they're putting this aggressive stance that, like, you know, there's absolutely no way. I mean, they're the ones that are being, like you said, insurrectionist. And so, I mean, it's hard to even imagine them, you know, repealing the sequester or even, you know, cutting it down. I mean,
you know,
it
was
down.
It was interesting because there's something that I noticed. You know, I was doing some research and found out that, and we all knew this, but how bad it's even worse now that most of this, in fact, the shutdown of the government is mostly affecting states, you know, the states that these congressmen are from, the Republican congressmen are from. The type of welfare that they want cut mostly affect people within their states. Then not accepting the Medicaid expansion to Obamacare affect most of the people in these red states as well. So you ask yourself the question, wow, that probably means that these guys would likely be in trouble when that society sees that they are more affected when this occurs. And then it came to mind, but wait a minute, no, because their electorate isn't the 47%, right? It isn't that group of folks who need a whole lot. Then I go back and I say, actually, yeah, it is. They just don't know it. In other words, a lot of the Tea Party folks that I'm seeing are folks without jobs, without health care, without all these different things. Then my next statement comes out and it says, why are we so bad at telling people the truth? In other words, and this is a dilemma that I am in and many of us are in that if I speak to some of my Republican folks right here in Kingwood, I can tell you I sat down in Starbucks with at least 10 different people that when they left Starbucks, and this wasn't just saying, Egberto, I am going to be a Democrat from now, they'll never say that. But the interest that I saw in not only the information that I was providing them, but in wanting to do other things, I am sure that these Republicans may be Republicans for the rest of their lives, but they will be voting their own values going forward. That's the resolve that I saw a lot of these folks walk out of Starbucks with. And I think that is something that all of us as individuals have to do. We have to personalize this stuff. Today I'm coming back. You have somebody that is a fairly liberal person. Well, you remember, you were there, Doc. Not thinking, oh, but isn't Obamacare bad about this? Tell me about Obamacare, because everything that I'm hearing is about negative. Come on, Doc.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of misinformation on the consequences, the effects of Obamacare. In part, that's because our media feels the need to show two sides of every issue, when in fact there may be only one side or more than one side on many issues. I think that's a huge problem. I do want to return briefly to what Neil said
Okay.
About the South's staying Democratic until the 90s, you have to separate out presidential elections from congressional elections. 68, Nixon carried almost all the South. 72, he carried all the South. It was only when Carter and Clinton, two Southerners, were running that the South has not gone Republican in presidential elections in the last 40, 45 years. At the congressional level, Republicans had a much tougher time gaining strength in the South, in part because of the power of incumbency and the difficulty of defeating incumbents. So I think the race issue is much more of an issue than Neil says. I mean, I agree it's not everything. But think about
actually, that was John.
Think about this last presidential election. Rick Santorum's in Iowa talking about cutting welfare. And he says, I don't want to make people dependent on government. And in the next sentence, he says, I want to help black people get jobs, not be dependent on government. And this is to a lily white audience. So race is still a major way they think. And if you don't think so, get into a conversation with somebody who is conservative and let them talk. And if you let them talk, sooner or later, that conversation will come around to race. Either affirmative action or welfare or one of those racial quotas, something in race. And a friend of mine pointed this out to me, so now when I get into conversations with conservatives, I let them talk, and sure enough, usually within the first 5 to 10 minutes of a conversation, race comes up. It's not the driving force, but it is definitely there under the surface.
But you know, Doc, I'm going to tell you, that is interesting. I'm a black guy, and it's funny here in Kingwood, right? Because I go to the gym, and I'm surrounded by all these conservative Republican folk. And when we get into very deep conversations, it's amazing when folks forget who they're actually talking to, what comes out. So I concur completely with what you say, and because a lot of these folks would say certain things, and then they'll come back and say, oh, but Egberto, I don't mean look, I don't care what you mean. I just want you to talk. I just want to hear I can only change you if I understand where you're coming from. That's why sometimes the messenger is important. And I bet that
are not people that are racist in
exactly.
the traditional sense.
I know. Right.
So we got to make that distinction.
Umberto, you know what's really amazing? It's just that these gerrymandered districts are like 1950. I mean, these white districts, I mean, you can't – it's like literally going back in time. That's what gerrymandering has done. It's basically the Republicans have taken it to an art form that we can't literally vote these people out. They're protected. So that's why they can say and do anything they want, because they there's no way to get them out.
You know, I'm a bit more of an optimist. Let me just say this real quick, John, and then come on in. I'm a bit of an optimist in that I think I still believe that all human beings, everybody, are intrinsically good, okay? And I say that after talking to folks that have said some of the most vile, racist things to me, and then as opposed to getting pissy, mad, I sit them down and then I say, now tell me exactly why you think that about me. Tell me exactly why you think that. What specifically makes you think that, feel that way? And then we can talk. And by the end of a conversation, sometimes it's like, damn, the person is, and I'm not going to lie to you, this doesn't occur to with all folk, but I'm saying with most folk it does occur. The person sits down and, you know, they come to a different realization. Now, deep inside, we are human beings, and you know there's a part of this primitive mindset that we have, and we all have a primitive section of our minds that works reflexively. In other words, before all the calculations go on into the brain, some very fast reactions occur down there, and that that you've grown up with all your life will always be there. Some people are predisposed to always be scared of black men. And even deep down on the inside, they know better. You know, that reflexive thing comes out until they're able to think things out. So, you know, those are things that have to be understood. But come on in, John. I just wanted to get that in.
Yeah, I mean, I also agree that gerrymandering is terrible. And there's a really good article or essay on Daily Kos last night by Ian Reifowitz, who came on as a front pager. Yeah, he's a professor in New York.
New York.
And he's excellent. He's an excellent writer and a professor probably also. And he talks about gerrymandering. And I agree that gerrymandering is a huge problem. Early in the show, I gave my view on it's a very hard – there's a very hard to have a solution on it. But one point I do want to talk about as far as gerrymandering is that, you know, you had this massive shift in 2006 where the Democrats won with, you know, with the 2000 census, drawn from the 2000 census. And then in 2008, they won even greater numbers, you know. And so, I mean, they had this, you know, pretty large lead. And in 2010, they were still using the 2000 census numbers. They hadn't, and so, you know, it hadn't changed that much. And there was just a revolt. I mean, people didn't know how to react to the economic crisis, and a lot of centrists blamed Obama. And so, and also what's happening, and I know this is kind of a Republican talking point, but I do think it's truthful. A lot of people who were, you know, what they call the creative class, are moving, and this has happened, you know, since the beginning of the 20th century, but I mean it's happening, it's continuing to happen even more now. And they're moving to larger cities. And you know, if you look at the population, you're getting more and more young people and more Democrats in large cities. And, you know, and so whenever they have, you know, the rural people who live in rural America are the ones that that have these gerrymandered districts that usually vote for Republicans. I mean, look at Austin, Texas. You know, if it was just divided into three districts or two districts, they would have, you know, it wouldn't just be Lloyd Doggett, you know, but the way they gerrymander it, it's, they, you know, Lamar Smith has his little section. Michael McCall has his little section, and he loses in Austin city limits, but you know he wins in the rural areas, and so he has enough rural voters to actually have him win. I mean, wins big, you know, by 20 points. And so, yeah, I mean, I believe this guy, I think his last name is Williams, is another one who has partially in Austin. And it's the same way here. I mean, you know, with Joaquin Castro. I mean, it really should be two Democratic areas if you just looked at. Look at the Congress. If it was, you know, I guess you can say that's a Democratic gerrymander. But people should be represented, though. And so I don't. I think gerrymandering is a problem. I don't know really what the solution is. I talked about earlier having these states like California do this. That's probably. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I hope it does. And I guess we'll have to go. A lot of it is just portraying information to people, like you were saying earlier, Egberto. As far as what Dr. Theis was talking that I was talking about with justice. I mean, I agree with you completely. I'm not trying to say that racism is over in America. Racism is very much alive and has a huge impact. But I do think, you know, if Hillary Clinton would have won in 2009, you would have seen a very similar Tea Party reaction. And I think they would be doing very similar things to thwart his agenda, thwart her agenda. And so I think that the rise of supply side, you know, trickle down economics has more of an impact than racism does. And as far as what I was saying about, I thought I mentioned Texas because I was talking specifically about Texas because I think Texas, you know, had, you know, like Lloyd Benson. He was in office until, I believe, until the 90s. And, yeah, I mean, in other southern states, it was much, much more Republican. And even legislatures, some of them were, until very recently, very Democratic. So yeah, that's, I mean, what
well,
you're
you know,
saying, I mean, I'm not questioning anything that he said. I think, you know, it's all completely factually correct, but you know, I think that Texas is a little bit different from the rest of, let's say, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana.
Hey, John. Oh, sure.
Go ahead.
John, could you imagine what's going to happen with the machine once Hillary is the front runner, if she decides to run, which she will? They'll be calling it the feminist emasculating nanny state. They will be going after her. I mean, it would be like every negative stereotype of a woman is going to be. It's going to be. I mean, it'll make racism look like nothing. They will go after. They're going. They are like they're drooling. They cannot wait for when she is the front runner because they are going to go after her as a woman, and it's going to turn off a very large amount of women who are 50% of the voters are female. And when
more
they see
50, yeah.
Yeah, what they're going to do to Hillary, it's going to make women furious because she's going to bring out everything that they're – all the misogyny that these people are. I mean, even the women and the men in the Republican Party. Don't leave out the women.
I kind of want Hillary to run because I know that Hillary – just like how there's a special first black person that had to run, Hillary is a special, what I call a special first woman that can win because of some of the gravitas, quote unquote. I mean, don't really need it because Bush was president. Come on. But some of the things that they would use against her, I think she's probably the one that is lined up to be able to squelch anything of a woman presidency. But Elizabeth Warren is really where my passion lies.
She might pick her as the vice president.
Man, wouldn't that be great? Woman ticket. That would be
excellent. Warren is she's not afraid of anyone.
I know. I love that woman. You know,
me
I
too.
I actually met her at Netroots 2011, and you would not imagine how nice she was. I was at first, you know, she was with a group of other senators, you know, and I wanted to approach her. And she saw that I was coming, and when I saw her talking to these other guys, that I was about to walk off, and she just kind of waved and said, hey, come on, come on. And I went and I kind of held her, said, hi, how you doing? And, you know, glad to see what you did, that sort of a thing, you know. But she's a small woman. I mean, on TV, I guess because she's so imposing when she's talking, you think she's a lot, you know, bigger in stature than she really is. But she's pretty small.
She is what's the name of the New Jersey governor? I forgot his name.
Chris Christie.
They are calling her the female Chris Christie. They say except that she has more credibility and she excites Hispanics and people of color and women more than Christie would ever because Christie is just boisterous.
Well, I just think that if she were to run, the attacks you talk about the attacks that would come against Hillary. Hillary is still also considered. Hillary is still within the edges of the plutocracy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this woman, Warren, I don't think she is. What do you think, Doc?
I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, I'd like to see Larry Summers banished from government, and if Hillary wins, that won't happen. So I'm for any woman but Hillary.
Okay, well then, we have to get Warren to run then. Anyway, guys, we're coming up on the time, so what I'm going to do is do the regular half four checkouts here. John, why don't you give me a closing statement?
All right, it's a great show. It's always great to – I think everybody contributed, you know, a lot. Always great to hear from Professor Theis. He's really has a great deal of knowledge, and he's always great to hear him. You know, I just hope that Republicans will come to their senses. I mean, they've got to understand that this cannot work forever. This is a losing political strategy. And, you know, they think this can just go on and they can just get more concessions, you know, slop off, you know, a CR for a month or two and get more concessions. That is not – you cannot win that way. I mean, I know the American public is apathetic, but this is affecting too many people, and, you know, they need to come to their senses, and I hope the ACA works for people. I love it when I hear how people are going to be helped. And as far as Elizabeth Warren, unfortunately, she said she wouldn't run, but I do want to say that in the Quinnipiac poll that came out, I guess it's been about 6 weeks now, she got the third highest rating. They only did it on a favorable, unfavorable. Chris Christie had the highest. Hillary Clinton had the second highest, and Elizabeth Warren was third. And so that was pretty impressive. Higher than Biden, higher than Rand Paul, higher than Ted Cruz, you know, higher than Jeb Bush or Rubio or Paul Ryan. So, I mean,
that
gives me a little faith in the American public.
Thank you very much, John. I hope to hear from you. Next week I am going to be in Austin, but I'll get somebody to do the show for me. But we'll talk. All right, John?
All right. Sounds good.
Thank
Great
you, man.
Show.
Give me a quick one, Neil.
No, I just want to say, I just to basically back up John, I hope that the Republicans realize that this is a violation of the 14th Amendment, what they're doing. And basically, it's also setting a very negative precedent when you have a minority basically using a blackmail and tyranny to force the majority that was voted in to their will. It's setting a very negative precedent, and it's really making this country look ridiculous.
Thank you very much, Neil.
You're welcome.
You're a good man. Jack Golden, a quick one, my brother.
Okay. Hope it's going to... Republicans get to their senses.
Thank you, buddy.
I have my serious doubts. I have my serious doubts.
Don't doubt it. Don't doubt it. Send the letters and send the calls. I got to go to Professor Tice, but thank you very much, Jack. Let's keep on talking and let's keep on doing our thing. Dr. Tice.
Well, I appreciate being on the show and listening to John and Neil and Jack. I think they were very good comments, and I really enjoyed it. I would just say I hope every progressive-minded person gets out and votes in 2014 and begins to defeat some of these people. And hopefully the Democratic Party will not just put up Republican light as their candidates in these areas, but really put up candidates that can articulate a vision for how our society can work on behalf of the working class and the poor and really provide opportunities that America used to provide.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tice. That was great. Thank you guys all for participating in the active discussion. I wish more of you listeners would have chimed in. A lot of you listening but not talking. Anyhow, please remember that Coffee Party Radio has 4 shows on Mondays. It's Press 1 for Democracy with Dan Aronson. On Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, it is The Middle Ground with Eric Beiler. On Thursdays, it is Lunch with Loudon. That's at 3 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays. And, of course, you're with me, yours truly, on Saturdays at 1 p.m. Eastern, 12 Central Standard Time, Politics Done Right with Egberto Willis. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time that you spent with me. I'd like to say one thing. I continue to post about quite a bit of what's happening currently during my time slot on the Coffee Party site. I want to ask those that sometimes comment on that site to please, other than commenting, feel free to send me direct mails. I respond to all of them with concerns and justifications. I love to hear from you. Continue sending me information. I love your comments. You have a wonderful day. Please remember to go to www.coffeepartyusa.com. join us, help us out. We need your memberships. You have a wonderful day. As Janine would always say, coffee party out. Have a wonderful Saturday, folks. Bye-bye.